the push to open Florida's primary elections to all of the state's voters. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a nice weekend. And just ahead on the show, should the state's primary elections be open to everyone, regardless of their party affiliation? Several groups are mobilizing to make that happen. We'll speak to one leader in just a moment with your calls. Give us a call now. Let us know what you think. It's 549-2937. Then later, award-winning journalist and author and historian Andrew Nagorski on his new book, 1941, The Year Germany Lost the War. Plus, Cole Pepper with a look at the College World Series. That's later in the hour. All of that ahead this morning. But first, this Monday, Florida has more than 3.5 million NPAs. That's no party affiliation voters. In fact, the state's NPAs or independents make up some 27% of the electorate. But Florida has a closed primary system, and that means if you are an independent or NPA voter, you don't have a voice in primary elections, which often decide the contest. Activists are working to change that leading up into next year's 2020 election. So this morning, we're taking a closer look at this as we welcome Steve Huff. He's director of Florida Fair and Open Primaries, Inc., and he's on the line. Stephen, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. Are you a Republican, a Democrat, or an NPA? What do you think of the push? This is to callers. What do you think of the push to open up Florida's primary elections? 15 other states have already done so. Should we do that here in Florida? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. And our Facebook page is open. And Steve, this is certainly an idea that has come up again and again in Florida, considering that the number of independent voters in this state is growing faster than either major political party. 27% of registered voters in this state, 3.6 million people, are independents, but they are shut out of voting in Florida's closed primary elections. And so tell us a little bit more about the campaign to open up the state's primary system. Why do you think this is important for Florida?
Well, it's important because, like you said, most times the primary is the deciding election, not the general election. And when you have 27% of the electorate that's not allowed to participate, you're not getting true representation. But it's pretty exciting what's going on right now. There are several different efforts. We began in earnest back in 2017 when the Florida Constitution Revision Commission was underway. If you recall, they held two public hearings, actually, in Jacksonville. I was in attendance at one of those. And we turned out activists at all these public hearings, which in fact made open primaries the second most popular issue raised. But as we know, the CRC failed to act. So my organization decided to form a political committee and start circulating some petitions. We did that back pretty soon after the CRC wrapped up their work. And we had volunteers. Matter of fact, in Jacksonville area was our biggest, most productive group of volunteers. They collected about 6,000 signatures in Jacksonville. But since then, another organization called All Voters Vote has raised big money to back the petition drive. And they came up with two separate petitions of their own. So we've ceded that effort to them. And they're currently underway collecting the petitions. The Florida League of Women Voters has endorsed them. And of course, the new law that Governor DeSantis just signed into effect last Friday is putting a damper on citizen initiatives.
But right. They've made it much more difficult for Floridians to get an initiative on the ballot and pass an amendment to the state constitution, which is what you're trying to do, right?
Right. Yeah, that bill was very disappointing, and we believe that it was a direct response to the success of past initiatives, John Morgan's initiative to legalize medical marijuana, and then, of course, in 2018, the Amendment 4 to restore the voting rights to convicted felons. We believe the legislature just wants to shut down citizens who, you know, are really calling them to task for not doing their job.
Right. But let me ask you as a follow-up. NPAs are leaving both of the major parties in this state. When you look at voter registration in Florida, as I said, 27% of registered voters are NPA, 35% are Republican, 37% are Democrat. And so both the Republican and the Democratic parties have lost voters. They've gone to independent because of frustration with both of the major parties. Yet it's both of the major parties, particularly the Republicans who run the legislature, that are preventing these types of popular reforms from being passed because entrenched interests don't want the kind of change, I think it's fair to say, that you're seeking. And so what is your strategy to get over a much higher bar now to get an initiative like this placed on the ballot to open up Florida primaries to everyone? 15 other states have done this, by the way. So what's your strategy, Stephen?
Well, our strategy has changed somewhat. As I said, All Voters Vote organization has really taken over the Citizens Initiative, which are trying to place a top two open primary on the ballot and change the Constitution. What we've done is we've joined a national campaign, which is sponsored by Independent Voting in New York City, and it's a 50-state strategy. Many states already allow independents, or NPAs, as they're called here in Florida, to vote in their presidential primaries. So we've joined this national campaign to get our Democratic Party and Republican parties to voluntarily say that they will allow NPAs only to participate in their primaries. Now, of course, it doesn't look like we're going to have a Republican presidential primary as such, so it's really affecting only the Democrats. And a fellow down in Miami by the name of Jeff Solomon, who ran as a Democratic candidate, won a primary for a state House seat in 2018, but then lost by a very narrow margin in the general election. He introduced a resolution in the Miami-Dade DEC, Democratic Executive Committee. It went through several committees. It finally passed back in April. And then the very next week, Brevard County passed the exact same resolution, which basically states that, you know, in light of, you know, what happened in the 2016 presidential primary, the complaints from the Sanders camp, and, you know, they had the big unity commission, and they're just saying that it's time to allow NPAs to participate in their presidential primary. So it's passed these two committees. It'll be voted on at their state convention in October, but it's still an uphill battle. A lot of Democrats, you know, they think it's a Republican plot to, you know, create mischief, and you know, we got to overcome.
And where does that perception come from?
You know, it's hard to say, but if you remember back in 2008 when Barack Obama challenged Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential primary, Rush Limbaugh came up with this thing, and he called it Operation Chaos. He was, you know, urging his followers to register as Democrat and go in and, you know, try to have an impact on the Democratic presidential primary, which all came to naught, and it's really a fallacy and an unjustified fear, because if there were actually Republicans that wanted to vote in the Democratic primary today, they could do so. Just they go online, change their voter registration 30 days prior to the primary, and vote as a Democrat. It's just that kind of unbelievable. The things that you hear in opposition against it. But we're collecting signatures online on a letter urging both Terry Rizzo and Joe Gruters, the chairs of both parties, to support the resolution. And we're going to continue to reach out to the committee members in the party across the state, So when October rolls around, we'll have a good bit of support for it.
And other states have gone through this process. As I mentioned, 15 states have open primaries. Have you looked to the process in other states as a guide to see how they made this change and what has been the result? How has it changed elections in states that have done this?
Well, there's, you know, when we say they have open primaries, there's many variations. Our original intent was to implement a top two open primary. That's the system that they have in California, Washington State, and Nebraska, where every candidate, you don't have partisan primaries. Every candidate for an office is on a single ballot. Everyone gets to vote, and the top two move on to the general election. Then some states have what are referred to as semi-open primaries, where the voter shows up on election day, says they want either the Democratic or the primary or the Republican primary ballot, and they vote accordingly. Then there's some states that allow the state parties to decide whether or not they want unenrolled voters to participate. So there's many variations of the open primary. That term gets used quite often without specific details of which plan we're talking about. So in Florida, there's two separate initiatives. One, the All Voters Vote Initiative, which would be a top two open primary, the same as California, Washington State, and Nebraska. And then our campaign, which is just asking the Democrats and Republicans to voluntarily allow NPAs to choose their ballot on primary day.
All righty. And let me go to some calls now for you. Stephen Huff, he's director of Florida Fair and Open Primaries, Inc. What do you think about the campaign to open up the state's primary elections to all voters? More than 25% of Florida voters are no party affiliated. They will not get to vote in the 2020 Democratic primary next year for president, is just one example, when many candidates will be on the ballot to decide the Democratic nomination for president. And there are a slew of local and statewide elections that they're shut out of as well. Let's go to Mike in Ponte Vedra Beach. Hi, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking up this topic. It's extremely important. Reforming our election system is one of the most important things we can do. I'm an NPA. I registered 10 years ago when I moved to the area, and I was surprised and frankly somewhat offended that a government official would be asking my party affiliation just for the right to vote. So I absolutely support what the topic is right now in reforming the system.
And where did you move from, Mike?
From Virginia.
And do they have an open primary system there?
They do.
And so you were able to vote in all elections there as an independent?
That's correct. And I haven't been able to vote in a primary since I moved.
Okay. But yeah, and you don't like it. Sounds like you don't like it. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, that's
no,
Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
Mike in Ponte Vedra. Stephen, this is something that's motivated your activism on this. You've heard from a lot of voters like Mike, right?
We have, and you know, that's the thing about Florida. One of the things about Florida is we have a lot of people that move here from other states, where they, were allowed previously to vote in primaries as independents, and they when they move to Florida, they just they're shocked that now they have to either choose a party or they don't get to vote. As a matter of fact, I live in the Panhandle in Panama City, and back during the CRC again, the public hearings, they held one here in Panama City, and at that that particular hearing, a fellow that was previously from Alabama, lived in Alabama, a retired engineer. He showed up at the hearing and he said, exactly the same thing, that Mike said. And he said, I just couldn't believe it. Being an independent, I couldn't vote in a primary. He said, you guys can't let Alabama be better than Florida. And everybody laughed. And then somebody mentioned football, and that was kind of the end of it. But yeah, we hear that a lot.
Okay.
From, transplants from other states.
And Dave is in Nassau County. Hi, Dave. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I couldn't stand either party, and I got registered NPA when I first got here from Florida, in Florida. And one of the things
where'd you come from,
Dave?
Where'd you come from?
I moved from Tennessee.
Okay.
And their primary was such that you chose at the time of the primary which party you were going to participate in, but you didn't have to declare your party affiliation when you registered.
Okay, so you felt that was a better system as well?
Well, yeah, certainly better than this, but I would also like to see ranked choice voting where we can start breaking the stranglehold that we have with the two-party system.
Thanks for that, Dave. That's another initiative, Stephen Huff, that has taken flight in other states around the country, along with same-day voter registration. What about that caller's suggestion of ranked choice voting? That is another option that some electorate boards are tinkering with in other states.
I'm glad that Dave mentioned that because Jackson, there's an organization that's kind of a coalition partner. We have a lot of coalition partners with different types of electoral reform. And Unite America, previously the Centrist Project, support independent candidates. And the the Northeast chapter leader, Perry Wagg, is in St. John's right there, and he's trying.
Right, he's been on the show. Yeah.
Right, yeah, you need to get him back on because he's trying to organize an effort to bring ranked choice voting to Duval County because of the runoff system.
And basically voters rank the candidates by preference on their ballots, and if a candidate wins a majority of the first preference votes, they are declared the winner, right?
Right, and then one does not receive the majority, they drop the person with the least amount of number one votes, and they redistribute their second choice votes they repeat the process until somebody crosses the.
And that avoids a runoff. Doesn't that just avoid a runoff election for the most
right.
part?
Yeah. Sometimes ranked choice voting is referred to as instant runoff voting.
Gotcha. All right. Jimmy is in downtown Jacksonville. Jimmy, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a Democrat. I'm a Democratic activist, and I am very resistant to this this scheme to invite Republicans and others who are not Democrats to pick our nominees. I think that you need to have Democrats select the Democratic nominee because we're the folks who are invested in the party, and then we go on to the election. If folks want to have a say in that, it's very simple. 21 days before the election, you register for the party, and off you go. Maybe there's something to be said for same-day registration that might somewhat ally my fear, but as it is now, with no Republican presidential primary in Florida in 2020, that's a lot of Republicans that may want to create some chaos in the Democratic primary, and I don't think we should have it.
Okay, Jimmy, thanks for that. And Stephen, that's the argument against this. People, partisans, whether you're Democratic or Republican, they feel pretty strongly that their primary base voters should have the say in the primary. What about that argument?
Well, our first comment would be that these primaries are publicly funded. Taxpayers pay for these. We have no objection to private organizations, holding their own exclusive nominating processes, but they shouldn't be supported by taxpayers. And as, the number of MPAs continues to grow, like you said, we're 27% of the electorate. That's a lot of taxpayers' money being spent on these primaries and not being allowed to participate. The second thing is the resolution that's going through and being debated within the Florida Democratic Party right now about the presidential primaries, it only applies to MPAs. And as the caller said, anyone can go online, change their registration now very, very simply, 30 days prior to a primary election. So there's no reason to exclude NPAs because anyone that is up to no good can do whatever they want to now. The resolution that's been introduced within the Democratic Party only applies to NPAs and would not encourage any additional mischief. So that's our basically our two responses to
the. Okay,
to that.
And lots of tweets coming into the show. James tweets, First Coast Connect, I'm totally against this idea. The Democratic nominee should be selected by Democrats. Matt tweets the show, most of these voters lean almost exclusively to one side or another. They carry the MPA designation as a way of feeling better about themselves. I'll get your response to that in a minute, Stephen. Mick tweets, I left the GOP in disgust for their corrupt, misogynist behavior, but I recognize that local candidates in Jacksonville usually win our general elections. I support open primaries, even if it means the Dems lose sooner. Here's one more tweet. Not only do we need open primaries, we need to eliminate the winner-take-all electoral college. Let's take a few more calls. Susan is in Mandarin. Susan, you're on the air.
Jimmy almost convinced me to change my mind. I am a proponent of open primaries. The way that we do it in Jacksonville, it's an open primary. You can vote for anybody. But instead of the top two people going to the general election, I wish it would be the top four people. I would offer as an example when it was Alvin Brown, Mike Hogan, and two of the other people that I thought were very qualified, Audrey Moran and Mulaney, I guess because they were more centrist, they were taking each other's votes, and so they didn't get in the top two, whereas right. they might have gotten in the top four. And I'd also like to add one more point. Your guest keeps saying that Republicans can change their party to Democrats and Democrats can change their party to the other one right before the election and vote. Well, I would like to say that NPAs can do that also. So I am in favor of the open primary because sometimes, like with Melissa Nelson and Angela Corey thing, I knew some Democrats that changed to Republican just so they could vote for Nelson over Corey. So sometimes, even if you're a staunch Democrat, there's no Democrats running. And so we don't have a voice at all. So I think that's the reason I'm for open primaries. Thank you.
All right, Susan, thanks for all of that. Stephen Huff, we're hearing lots of interesting arguments and perspectives from all our listeners and people tweeting the show. You know, let me ask you, somebody tweeted a minute ago, people who are NPA already lean to one side or the other. Do you agree with that?
That is probably accurate, but there are some things that should be pointed out. That perception really comes from the type of polling that's done of independents. They'll, you know, they'll poll independents, and then if they respond, they'll ask them, are they Republican, Democrat, Independent, or, you know, something other. If they say Independent, there's immediately a follow-up question. Well, do you lean Democrat or Republican? And most people will, you know, say, well, you know, they lean one way or the other. So the polling, you know, sets that up to be true. But independents are based, you know, well, I can't speak for all independents because, you know, I only know my own situation and
what's your situation?
The people that I interact with. But independents, basically, they span the political spectrum.
And why are you an independent voter?
I'm an independent voter. I've always been in it. I've never been a member of a party. Mm-hmm. It's because I want to, you know, I want to look at, you know, the candidates, hear what they're saying, what their policy, you know, positions are. Do they make sense to me? And vote accordingly. That's why I like the top two, is because, you know, there may be a Democrat in for one seat that you like. There may be a Republican. There may be an Independent or a Libertarian or a Green. You know, who knows? The political duopoly is not doing us any services. There's a, you know, and the other caller that mentioned the top four, you know, I appreciate, you know, the conversation because it makes people think. I wish that, you know, people would take it a step further and get out of their partisan boxes. The top four open primary is a perfect solution if you follow it up with ranked choice voting in the general election. And this is something that's proposed by Catherine Gale and Michael Porter in a Harvard Business Study report on our political industrial complex that they published. Your listeners can, you know, look it up. It's, I believe the title is why political competition is failing in America. It's a great study. So there's, you know,
almost out of time, Stephen, real quickly before we let you go, what are the next steps for this movement in Florida?
Keep the conversation going, keep opening, you know, people's minds to, you know, alternatives, making them recognize that, you know, the partisan political duopoly is failing us. It's not representative of the people. You know, a small fraction of people turn out to vote in primaries. Our representatives are being selected by, you know, very, very small percentages of actual citizens. So we need to change that.
Stephen Huff, Director of Florida Fair and Open Primaries, on the line from the Panhandle. Stephen, good to talk to you, and thanks for all this. Appreciate you being with us.
Well thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your audience.
Much more still ahead later in the hour. Cole Pepper on the College World Series. But up next, best-selling author Andrew Nagorski. We'll be right back.
Damn this traffic jam. How I hate to be late. It hurts my motor to go so slow. Damn this traffic jam. Time I get home, my supper will be cold. Damn this traffic jam. Well, I left my job about 5 o'clock. It took 15 minutes to go 3 blocks. Just in time to stand in line with the freeway looking like a parking lot. Damn this traffic jam.
Sporer Dodd is a personal injury law firm based in Jacksonville with over 150 years of legal experience. Sporer Dodd is known for their legal expertise, experience, and results. Learn more at sdlitigation.com.
WJCT's new podcast tells the stories of local people.
You have one of your soldiers laying there. And you have the person that is trying to kill your soldiers on the opposite side.
It wasn't so much that I felt guilty. I felt like it was impossible for him to love me.
I wasn't born with a crack pipe in my mouth. Thank you, Jesus. I'm not going to die with one.
What It's Like is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
If you don't know his name, you know his work. Join WJCT on June 18th for an evening with Frontline's Michael Kirk, an award-winning documentarian. For tickets and more info, visit wjct.org/events.
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Christina, what's on the front page of today's Times Union?
At the top of the page, Florida lawmakers made...
Around the country, volunteers are reading local newspapers to people with vision loss or print disabilities. Did you know WJCT has this service? On a special radio we provide, you'll get the Florida Times Union every day. Learn more at wjct.org/radio reading. With help from sponsors like Florida Eye Specialists, Radio Reading gives voice to the printed word.
Welcome back. The North Florida TPO, Transportation Planning Organization, is updating its regional long-range transportation plan. And you can be a part of it if you join their telephone town hall this week. Executive Director Jeff Sheffield is here now with more. And Jeff, this is like calling into a radio show like this one in a way, isn't it?
It is. It's definitely a new attempt here to reach more of the public. I think as a public sector, we've been very traditional with our public meetings, and it's the expectation that people get in their cars and come to the building. This is a whole new way to hopefully access more residents.
Now, this is a way for the average commuter, anyone who lives around town, to help the TPO address travel and transportation needs for the next 20 years. This is the future of our transportation grid. People just need to register to be part of this town hall on your special website.
Yes. And all they need to do is register, and then they can call in and participate. They can go to pathforward2045.com. This is the long-range transportation plan for the region for the next 20 years. So this is how we'll be spending federal funding and state funding in our region. They can log in, call in. They can either just listen to the conversation, or if they wish to offer their remarks, they can do that as well. So it's very flexible.
Mm-hmm. So everybody out there who's driving around and listening to this, if they have gripes about the way this region is laid out, this is their chance to impact the future decisions.
Yes. Feel free to gripe to us. Feel free to compliment us. Feel free to offer all your thoughts.
Full disclosure, North Florida TPO is an underwriter here at 89.9. And at the same time, we always enjoy having you on to educate people about how important your organization is. You are in charge of this entire huge far-flung region's transportation and infrastructure apparatus. It's a lot of moving parts.
It is. And when we're talking about the context of what this plan will look like, we're probably talking about $25 to $30 billion over the next 20 years of need. And the decisions will be made with the expectation of more like $14 or $15 billion in revenue. So we're going to have a lot more need coming out of this exercise than the money. Mm-hmm. And so the public's input will help us decide on which projects make the most sense.
More and more people are moving here. It's straining the grid.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. We're expecting this area to almost double in population over the next 20 years, correct?
Yeah, Florida and this region are very popular. And so that's a good thing. We just need to make sure that we're planning for it and make sure we can manage the needs.
Okay, so there will be two telephone town hall meetings this week. One is this Wednesday night at 6:30 p.m. The second one, Thursday, June 13th, also at 6:30 p.m. As Jeff said, you can be part of this. You just need to go to the website, pathforward2045.com. That's pathforward2045.com. Register and be part of the conversation looking at the long-range transportation future of the First Coast. And you can talk to some pretty cool people. So like I said, it'll be kind of like a radio show, so it'll be fun, yep. Right?
Yeah, it should be fun. Looking forward to it. It's new for us, too.
Jeff Sheffield of North Florida TPO, always good to talk to you.
Thanks
for being with us.
Sure.
We'll be right back after this short break. Well, 1941 was a critical turning point year in World War II, and it's the subject of a new book, 1941, The Year Germany Lost the War. Best-selling author, historian, and former Newsweek editor Andrew Nagorski, who's currently based in St. Augustine, takes us on a deep dive into that critical year, and he's on the line now with a look inside. Andrew, good to talk to you.
Always good to talk to you, Melissa.
And it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Of course, you're a best-selling author and historian, former Newsweek editor, and you know this subject well. You've written about the Nazis to great acclaim before. Tell us about what motivated this new book, looking at that critical year of 1941.
Well, as you know, yes, I've written about this general subject area before, the rise of Hitler, some key moments in the war, the aftermath, the Nazi hunters after the war. But when I was a foreign correspondent based in Germany, Russia, Poland, and other places, I was always fascinated by the way the role of individuals play, whether they are leaders or activists or individual citizens, in major changes in history. In my case, I got to witness the downfall of communism in Eastern Europe in 1989. And I was and the interplay between the activists, like the Solidarity activists, the independent trade union in Poland, the Soviet dissidents, and others, along with what role the various leaders played, whether it's Ronald Reagan, Pope John Paul II, or Mikhail Gorbachev. And as I, as I've been doing more and more research and interviewing people who still are there, the last survivors of this period, it became apparent to me that these events in 1941 really determined the general, the course of the war. They didn't determine exactly how long the war would go on, of course, and there were various decisions later on that were critical. We've just observed the very moving commemoration of the 75th anniversary of D-Day. But I think all the ingredients of Germany's failure, of Hitler's failure, thank God his failure, are visible in 1941. If you just look at the beginning of the year and what happened by the end of the year, you realize this radical change took place. And there was no way Germany was going to win this war without the beginning of the year. They really were in control and looked like Hitler could actually make good on all his grandiose promises and threats.
Right. And as we spent the weekend marking the D-Day observances, the 75th anniversary of D-Day, of course, that came several years later. But as you write, at the start of 1941, Hitler was on the march across most of Europe. Winston Churchill was the lone holdout, battling Hitler essentially all alone. Hitler was affiliated with Stalin and the Soviet Union. The U.S. was hesitating, afraid to get involved, reluctant to get involved. Roosevelt didn't want to lead America into war. But then a series of events happened, including the attack on Pearl Harbor, which motivated the U.S. to get into the war. And then Hitler also made the disastrous decision to invade the Soviet Union and fight a two-front war. Those are two of the major events that turned the tide, thankfully. And so for younger listeners out there especially, I think your book is so important to read because in 1941, at the beginning of that year, things were looked as bleak as they could possibly look for the free and civilized world. It was truly terrifying for those who are still alive that remember that time. It could have easily gone another way.
Absolutely. There was no guarantee of success. And I think we all have a tendency to look back at history, especially when it's taught in the classroom or in a very sort of presented in a dry way as saying, oh, it had to work out this way. There was no way Hitler could have won in the long run. Well, if you look at that situation beginning of 1941, and even look at Churchill, who's this symbol of defiance. He's the one person who really stands between Hitler and victory at that point. And he's making, you know, his famous speeches, we will fight on the beaches, we will fight in the cities, everything. But at the same time, I dug up various things that indicated how he was worried when he took over as prime minister in 1940 after Germany defeated France. He told his bodyguard something like, "I'm not coming in too late. Basically, that it may be too late. I'm facing such an enormous task." The public persona was always, "We're going to win. We're going to emerge victorious." But in private, even one of his strongest supporters, one of the members of parliament, Harold Nicholson, he and his wife had taken poison pills, were ready to commit suicide if Germany invaded and took over. So this was a very perilous time, and his defiance, and then Roosevelt, bringing Roosevelt along to coax the U.S. to help Britain more and more, providing aid, but still not directly involved in the war because there was a strong isolationist movement in the United States. But then Hitler is this compulsive gambler, keeps upping the ante, and eventually loses by, as you say, invading the Soviet Union, totally miscalculating the odds there, and making a number of tactical mistakes. And military mistakes, as well as political mistakes, that erased him against the Soviet Union. And by the end of the war, when Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, by the way, we did not declare war on Germany first. We declared war on Japan after Pearl Harbor on December 8, 1941. And then Hitler declares war on the United States a couple of days later, and then we're really in the war. But even then, it took Hitler's declaration of war on the United States and Hitler's Hitler kept thinking every escalation is going to be good for me, when in fact, by the end of the year, the Allies, which are now Britain, the United States, and the Soviet Union, have twice the GDP, three times the population, seven times the territory, and in a long war, you can't win that kind of war.
We're in a very different era today. We're dealing with a different kind of threat to America in the form of cyber attacks in particular. What lessons can be drawn from a study of World War II when you apply it to today's geopolitical situation?
I think it's hard to apply directly to something like cyber attacks, because cyber attacks, of course, are very different than direct military attacks, where you clearly see what enemy army is attacking you. But I think one of the lessons I think of Hitler's rise to power and how the West responded to it is that when a radical leader takes charge and makes threats, and take those threats seriously. When Hitler was coming to power and he was saying, "I'm going to conquer the East," meaning Poland, the Soviet Union, everything. "I'm going to eradicate, basically kill the Jews," using various kinds of language, but it was pretty explicit. Most people said, "Oh, he can't mean that literally." Well, the lesson is, it's better to take it literally and act on that assumption than to think this is just rhetoric. You cannot assume a rational frame of mind. Again, in terms of leaders who are making those kinds of threats, it's rational from their point of view. And one of the things I tried to explore in this book, 1941, the year Germany lost the war, is the mindset of Hitler, why he thought each time the situation got bad for him, he should escalate further. For instance, a lot of his aides, military aides, economists, were saying Germany shouldn't take on all these countries. But in the early days, all of Hitler's gambles paid off. He swallowed Austria. He dismembered Czechoslovakia. He took over. He defeated Poland. Then he defeats the way he moves west and Denmark, Norway, France. And so many of his aides began to believe, well, this man can do no wrong. And then when they said, if you start attacking the Soviet Union, if you attack the Soviet Union, which is so much larger, its manpower is so much larger, in the long term, you can't win either. And Hitler's conclusion was, therefore, we've got to do it in the short term. We can have another quick victory. So if in the long term we're going to be outgunned, we'll score a victory first. When he was stalled in Britain, he didn't manage to bomb Britain into submission. Remember, he was bombing London.
And we're almost out of time, Andrew, almost out of time.
Yeah.
Doing any appearances in the 30 seconds or so we have left around town to promote your book?
I will be at Fleet Landing on, June 25th, I believe. June, I've got to check the schedule. It's on my website, andrewnagorski.com. But it's coming up, and then I'm doing others now in Washington, New Orleans.
All right, it's Andrew Nagorski, and the book is 1941, the year Germany lost the war, out this week. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Up next, Culpepper with a look at the College World Series and the latest on the Jags. We'll be right back.
Tourism dominates the economy of Key West today, but that's a relatively recent development. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll look at early Key West industries, including commercial fishing, cigar manufacturing, and salvaging shipwrecks. We'll discuss Florida's relationship with Cuba and drive-in movie theaters. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
A Justice Department report found Alabama's prisons have the highest homicide rate in the nation. One inmate in that system heard our coverage and wrote us a letter. He says inmates have never felt so unsafe.
We never just felt like our life being in danger the way it is today. Basically, everybody incarcerated feels in danger.
A view from inside Alabama's prisons this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air...
There is nothing that I won't do to defend what's mine.
Damian Lewis plays a ruthless hedge fund owner in Showtime's Billions. He also played a Marine sergeant in the series Homeland, King Henry VIII in Wolf Hall, and Army Major Richard Winters in the HBO series Band of Brothers. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Is it time to vote down the Electoral College? 15 states have voted to grant their electoral votes to whoever wins the national popular vote. Oregon is the latest. Could this change the presidential outcome in 2020? Is it even constitutional? Reexamining the Electoral College. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap-Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Well, in his final year as head coach at Florida State Baseball, Mike Martin is going back to the College World Series.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper is here now with a look at that and the rest of the weekend sports news and notes. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, what a story it is for Mike Martin. 40 years as the head coach at Florida State. He announced earlier this year that this would be his last year coaching at FSU. He's the all-time winningest coach in the NCAA in any sport. And here he goes through a season where there were plenty of ups and downs. Florida State was one of the last four teams to get into the NCAA tournament. Mm-hmm. And here they are earning their trip to Omaha, capping off a remarkable run of the Super Regionals with a 12-inning win over LSU last night. Martin's been the head coach of the Noles and has won more games than anybody. But the one thing lacking on his resume is a national championship, a win of the College World Series. This is the 17th time he's been to the College World Series. They've never won a national championship.
He's the Susan Lucci of this field.
listen, this would be as if Tom Hanks never won an Oscar.
They're
talking about a guy who is the most successful coach by any metric except for national championships.
He's got to get this then.
You know, and this is not a vintage Florida State team. This has not been his best team by any stretch of the imagination, but wouldn't it be the perfect ending to a legendary career if he could bring back the championship? Yesterday after the game in Baton Rouge, his wife of 55 years is on the field with him and video captured him saying, "I'm just so excited, I can't even stand it." And she's just giggling, and he goes over to the Florida State fans and says, "My four favorite words, see you in Omaha."
Why do they have it in Omaha, by the way?
It's been a tradition. Part of it, I think, is because years ago, Rosenblatt Stadium, where the games used to be held, was a AAA ballpark, and that's about a good size for a big college baseball event in the day. It was available. The folks who ran the Omaha Royals then, the Royals AAA affiliate, were willing to go on a long road trip for a couple of weeks while the College World Series was played there. And it's central in the country, and that certainly helps.
Yeah, sure.
One other side of the Omaha thing, of course, in the Midwest, barbecue is big, and there's a barbecue restaurant right near Rosenblatt Stadium, which is also right near the Omaha Zoo, by the way. And if you lose, it's a double elimination format. If you lose your first two games and you're gone, they used to say, and still do in some regards, it's 0-2 in barbecue.
So hey, it's a consolation prize.
That's the best you get. They've moved on to a new stadium now in Omaha, but still the same feeling pervades.
All right. I'm sure you've sampled some of that barbecue at some point
in
your life.
I have been there a couple of times. I will say the College World Series is one of my absolute favorite events every year. I think more than any other major event that I can remember, you have fans rooting for their teams and not rooting against the other guy. And that's sometimes a rare thing in sports these days.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I hope he gets it. Let's root for him to have that as the capstone to his career. Meanwhile, the Jaguars this week are holding their 3-day minicamp.
Yeah, the mandatory minicamp starts tomorrow
We expect all the Jaguars veterans to be there. That would include Jalen Ramsey and Leonard Fournette and Yannick Ngakoue, who have missed some or all of the offseason voluntary practices so far. Well, the guys who have been on the field so far for the Jaguars, I want to make a couple of observations. First, about Nick Foles. You can clearly see this is a guy who knows what he's doing in the position. He's comfortable with a new offense that's being installed. He's worked in the past with the new offensive coordinator, John DeFilippo. And I think you're immediately going to see an upgrade in that position in terms of consistency, ball placement, and everything you want to see out of a quarterback. Leadership has been terrific. The receivers are the real wild card for this team right now. They brought in Terrell Pryor, the former quarterback turned wide receiver, to try to bolster the group. Marquise Lee's still coming off an injury. The free agent addition, Chris Conley, has looked very good. But I think this is the one area of the team that we can expect it's sort of a boom or bust this year for the Jaguars, and that could go a long way to determining just how much of a contender they are. The mood with the Jaguars right now among the guys that are there has been very good. Doug Marrone saying last week that he really liked the way the team worked throughout their OTAs, the offseason organized team activities.
Can people come out and check out the minicamp?
Minicamps practices are closed. And the first time they'll have a chance to come out and see the Jaguars will be during training camp, which will begin in late July.
And last but not least, for golf fans, the U.S. Open is this week.
Yeah, coming off the Canadian Open, where Rory McIlroy shot a final round 61 to win. Rory will be one of the golfers to look for. Interesting that the tournament final round yesterday began with three former players champions tied for the lead, Rory McIlroy, Webb Simpson, and Matt Kuchar. McIlroy had the big final round and wins. The other guy to follow is going to be Brett Koepka, because he's a guy who, coming off the PGA win and the way he's played in majors, Brooks Koepka certainly has to be one of the players to watch. And then, of course, Tiger Woods.
Uh-huh.
Could Tiger win at Pebble Beach, where he's had some of his great moments in his career? I'm not sure that his game is at the spot where he can win at Pebble. The Masters made some more sense for him as he won, but hey, it's Tiger. I'm not betting against him.
Always follow Cole on Twitter, at Cole Pepper. Check him out every night on the news, giving you all the sports. It's our news partner channel for the local station. Always good to see you. Thanks.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our show director. And we value your feedback. Send comments to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, a conversation with Michael Kirk of PBS Frontline. He will be speaking here at WJCT this month. Tune in tomorrow for that. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, keep listening for the Electro Lounge. We'll see you Tuesday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.